of Human Bondage by W. Somerset Maugham. This is a semi-autobiographical novel of a young man's painful progress towards maturity. It is set in the late 19th, early 20th centuries of England, Germany, and France. The principal characters are Philip Carey, an awkwardly handicapped but intelligent and responsive young student, Philip's intellectual friend Hayward, and Sally, Philip's long-awaited bride. Torn from the home of his dying mother as a young boy, Philip Carey was sent to live with his uncle, the vicar, in a small English village. It was with mixed feelings, however, that the childless clergyman and his wife took on the guardianship of their sensitive, club-footed nephew. Soon after Philip's arrival at the vicarage, they decided to enroll him in a religious boys' school where the students were encouraged to aspire to holy orders. Though at times bitterly frustrated by his impairment, 9-year-old Philip relied on his astute mind to survive and excel among the classmates. Over the next several years, a wave of religious fervor spread throughout the school. Always eager for new experiences, Philip joined the circle of the devout, and every night before the lights went out, he read earnestly from the Bible. One night he came across a passage that particularly excited him. "If ye have faith and doubt not, ye shall say unto the mountain, Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, it shall be done. And all this, whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing ye shall receive." When he heard the same words repeated in a sermon on the following Sunday, the young boy received them as an epiphany. Fervently he fell to his knees and asked God to make his club foot whole. For the rest of his holiday break he continued in this attitude of prayer. When at last school reconvened and Philip saw that his abnormality was still not repaired, he consulted his uncle. "Supposing you asked God to do something and really believed it was going to happen, like moving mountains, and you had faith and it didn't happen, what would it mean?" he asked. The uncle replied curtly, "It would just mean that you hadn't got faith." Although he did not see how his faith could possibly have been any stronger, Philip did not demur. Perhaps this passage, like many other biblical verses his elders had explained to him, somehow meant something quite different from what it actually said. But as the next few years passed, Philip found he could no longer fully embrace the passion of his former faith. Daily religious exercise slipped into mere formality, his classes became cumbersome, and the prospect of ordination oppressed him. After much argument, Philip's aunt and uncle allowed him to continue his studies in Germany under the guidance of a local professor. There, Philip experienced for the first time in his 18 years a sense of beauty and freedom. After 3 months at school in Heidelberg, Philip was assigned a new roommate, a scholarly 26-year-old Englishman named Hayward. Though new acquaintances generally tended to disgust him, Philip rapidly took a liking to his fellow student and soon found himself thirsting for their daily walks and discussions. When Hayward left Heidelberg to tour Italy, Philip was at a loss. Back home in England, however, he struck up a close friendship with the daughter of a former rector, a Miss Wilkinson. In the meantime, his guardian took him aside to discuss his future. Philip flatly refused to attend Oxford University, where his uncle had hoped he could study on a scholarship for his degree. But his aunt continued to aver, however, that there were only three professions worthy of a gentleman: army, church, and law. With his club foot and his unwillingness to accept ordination, the first two options were ruled out. This left only law. Immediately, Philip's uncle contacted the family solicitor. Though this gentleman said that though he had no room for Philip as an apprentice in his own law firm, he knew of a position elsewhere. Philip, sensing that a move to London would be a great opportunity, accepted the position and made plans to leave within the month. Meanwhile, over time, Philip had grown even fonder of Miss Wilkinson. One Sunday evening, while he was calling on her family, the object of his interest complained of a headache and coyly retired to her room. Not surprisingly, Philip offered to stay and attend her, if necessary, while the others left for an engagement. When the house had emptied, he crept up to the door of Miss Wilkinson's room. After what seemed like hours, he finally turned the handle, and there she stood, wearing just her petticoat. In that instant, a sensation of horror washed over him. Was this love? But despite his revulsion, he also felt a tinge of conceit. After all, even with his deformity, another human being had finally demonstrated an attraction to him. Not long after the tepid consummation of his attachment to Miss Wilkinson, Philip set off for London. Unfortunately, the novelty of his new work quickly evaporated. Some nights he would just sit outside a window, watching the people and wondering if he would ever experience any sense of true belonging or joy. Spring came, and Philip looked forward to Hayward's London homecoming. His hopes were dashed, however, by a letter from his friend that extolled the delights of springtime in Italy. Hayward had decided to stay on and enjoy them. "There are only two things in the world that make life worth living, love and art," the letter continued. "My feeling is that one should look upon life as an adventure and expose oneself to danger. Why do you not go to Paris and study art? I always thought you had the talent." When the end of the year came, Philip decided to act on Hayward's advice. But his uncle would have no part of this plan. "Going to Paris to be an artist," he sputtered. "What a bohemian idea." Why, no Christian gentleman," his uncle added, "would participate in such an act." "Well," Philip replied disgustedly, "I know I'm not a Christian, and I'm beginning to doubt I'm a gentleman." Since his uncle had refused to provide for him in Paris, and it was still 3 long months before Philip, now 20, would receive his small inheritance, he ended up scrounging for bed and board at Antonio's art school in Paris, where he learned there was very little work to be found in painting, unless one did portraits for rich Americans. With the advent of summer, many Parisian artists retired to the countryside. Philip, finally sustained by his inheritance, joined in the sabbatical. He had but one life to live, he reminded himself earnestly, and it was important to do things right. But after 2 years of the artist's life, Philip received some frank advice from his art teacher to the effect that he should get out while he could. Feeling sufficiently liberated, if not successful, he returned to the vicarage where his aunt had recently died. It was during this interlude at the vicarage that Philip first read Darwin's The Origin of Species. In The Struggle for Life, depicted so graphically between its covers, the young man found an intensity and grandeur that he had never before encountered. Raptly turning the pages, he was swept by a flood of new religious elation. On one side of his life lay society's barren and repressive formalities. On the other, like a sun, shone the laws of natural selection. At last he had found the true measure of good and evil. Now 25, and resplendently armored in his new Darwinian vision, Philip once again set out to conquer life in London. The exam he had passed earlier to certify for his accountancy easily qualified him to enter medical school. And romance soon crept back into his life in the emaciated form of a consumptive young waitress named Mildred. But the star of Darwinian optimism soon burned itself out. Every morning, Philip awoke with tortured thoughts of Mildred, who snubbed and belittled him at every turn. Desperately, the lover persevered, only to find himself recoiling in disgust when Mildred at last relented to his advances. In some perverse way, spurning the love he had finally won from the woman who had once enthralled him brought a new dimension of freedom to Philip's life. Philip returned to his medical studies with a new and well-grounded vigor. Having failed twice, this time he worked harder than ever. When he took the exam for the third time, he passed it with honors and stepped into his new career as an outpatient clerk at the hospital. Then, when he was in his late 20s, life suddenly passed once again out of Philip's control. It was 1914, and World War had reared its hideous head. Soon, nearly all of Philip's old friends and classmates were dead or fighting in the trenches. No one knew where the future of Europe lay. To distract himself, Philip carelessly played the stock market and disastrously lost. He could no longer afford medical school, and he was soon put out on the street. Though he had always been poor, until now the possibility of starving had never entered his mind. Poverty of this order was for Philip, as it was for every respectable middle-class Englishman, a disgraceful and dehumanizing disease. The crippled orphan from the vicarage, who had fought to form a niche for himself in the world, now once again found himself on the outside looking in. Through the next months, Mr. Athony, a kind-hearted acquaintance from Philip's hospital, often invited the young man to dine with him and his family. And finally, with Mr. Athony's assistance, Philip landed a job as a clerk in a department store. As the war raged on, Philip avoided the places he had frequented in happier times. His great consolation was a ripening friendship with Mr. Athony's daughter, Sally. That same year, his uncle passed away, leaving him enough of an inheritance to finish medical school and to ask Sally to marry him. Finally, at the age of 30, Philip Carey was able to find peace in a world that had both enslaved and rejected him. He now saw the underlying sameness of all the elusive dreams and passions that had once repressed him. From his childhood ardor for a biblical God, through his worshipful pursuit of Hayward's intellect, of art and bohemianism, of Darwinian struggles, and of an unattainable woman, he had been chasing the same chimera. All his life he had followed the ideals that other people, by their words or their writings, had instilled in him, and never the desires of his own heart. Always his course had been swayed by what he thought he should do, and never by what he wanted with his whole soul to do. Now, with a gesture of impatience, Philip put all of this aside. Henceforth, he would follow his own soul. As he pressed his hand in Sally's and walked out into the street, he saw that the cabs and omnibuses and people were hastening in every direction, and that the sun was shining. W. Somerset Maugham refers to Of Human Bondage, published in 1915, as an autobiographical novel. In a sense, perhaps, writing this book helped Maugham to exorcise the unhappy recollections of his own early life. The plot is almost void of explicit action. Instead, it transports the reader on a journey through one young man's developing selfhood as he struggles to find a center of meaning in the callow world around him. The intensely personal drama follows Philip Carey through his many new beginnings, aborted careers and relationships, and finally to his epiphanic proclamation, "If one has lived thoroughly, then life has a meaning and a pattern as rich, though as unsymmetrical, as those formed by the colors of an oriental rug."